Good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Chris Cherniak, sitting in for John Wells this morning. Well, today we begin with a conversation with Dr. Regan Zane from Utah State University at about an electric vehicle charging track that has been piloted for the last few years. That's right, this charging track would allow electric vehicles to recharge themselves while driving over it. It's the technology of the future today, and will be tested out on a real stretch of road. We'll tell you exactly where it is. You have to stay tuned.
That's right.
That's called a tease.
It's called a tease.
Very well. Good.
Good morning, Chris. Nice to have you. Thanks for being here this morning.
Sure.
Then we'll speak about a unique business coming to Park City. Tomorrow, in fact, is its grand opening on Ute Boulevard and Kimball Junction. And now it's a business that will allow private individuals access to a super resolution microscope. Super resolution.
It's something I've been wanting to do for years.
So high is this resolution, in fact, that the new business, Park City Microscopy, I knew I was going to not say that right.
It's a good job.
Microscopy Core, right. It's called, is one of a kind. And we'll find out why it's so special when Dr. Brian Bennett and Hosea Bynum join us to share their excitement. Grand opening tomorrow. And this is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Well, several years ago, news broke from Utah State University that an electric charging track would be built. Now, this is new technology, or was new technology, that ultimately would allow electric vehicles to drive over a track embedded in the road to charge. No more plugging in after searching for charging stations, which is currently what electric vehicle owners do. This would be simply driving over this specialized charging track. And a pioneer in this technology, Dr. Regan Zane from Utah State University, has now traveled the world talking about what he's done at USU. And he joins us now. We spoke with him a couple of years ago when this news first broke, and it was so interesting. So we're so happy that Dr. Regan Zane can join us. Good morning to you, Dr. Zane.
Good morning, Lynn, and what a pleasure to be back on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I've really been wondering about that electric charging track, and I haven't made my way up there north to Logan to see it. But tell us sort of the history of how it came to being, because it's my understanding, if I remember correctly, that this was a one of its kind in the U.S.
Absolutely, and we'd love to host you up here. You might have picked a bad time of year. You better let things warm up a bit.
But yes.
So this has come to be, of course, any major effort like this is a culmination of efforts of many individuals, many groups, and it's a coming together, essentially, of many, many, many efforts. This has been years in the making. There's been significant interest, of course, in growing adoption of electric vehicles, in the impact that can have on our economy and environment. This facility plays a key role in that space. That's what we'll be talking about here today. The facility has come together as a combination of funding from the state of Utah, investment and efforts from Utah State University, and now a consortium of collaborative efforts on multiple universities that are part of our research center, and now a broad industry base that we've pulled into this effort as well.
So the track itself is constructed, and it's been in a pilot program for how long now?
So the electric vehicle and research facility, construction was completed about a year and a half ago. The research center, the Sustainable Electrified Transportation Center, that is the consortium of universities and industry that are really utilizing this EVR facility to develop new technologies related to electric vehicles and charging infrastructure, in particular this concept of electric roadways, has been formed over the past year. We now have over a dozen companies associated with this industry partnership. We have multiple projects that are running here in the center. And in fact, this year we've had two major demonstrations. One, we held a conference on electric roadways and vehicles in May and demonstrated the first demonstration of in-motion, you know, charge-as-you-go concept out here on the track. And then we had our annual meeting of the Select Research Center with about 40 or 50 company representatives, national labs, and a number of state and local agencies present here in September. And at that demonstration, we showed multiple pads that are integrated into our roadway, charging an electric bus as we operated that over the track.
Wow.
So, Doctor, what's the science behind this? What's going on here?
So the science behind the electric roadway concept, there are really two primary ways that we can provide electric roads. The concept is that we charge as we go. It's really a shift between having a battery-centric solution on vehicle and a battery solution being moved off vehicle and onto the grid, allowing vehicles to be significantly lighter and significantly cheaper. And we can talk as we go here how that can impact the economics of electric vehicles. One solution to that is you can have a conductive charging, meaning you drag a cable or you have an overhead line like an electric trolley, and you connect to that electric system. Unfortunately, systems like that really only work well for, let's say, large vehicles like a transit vehicle or a large truck, and they have shock hazards, and they're also a bit obstructive for the environment around them. Another concept, which is the one that we're demonstrating here, is to actually transfer that energy wirelessly. And the science behind that is essentially the same as a transformer, but we have an air gap between what we call the primary coil that sits in the roadway embedded in the concrete, and we have a secondary coil that's attached to your vehicle. Those two create a magnetic field that couples them and allows us to transfer energy from the grid in the roadway to the vehicle on that receiving pad.
Okay, so this is basically a strip of coil or so that's inserted into an existing roadway?
That's correct. And really the challenge and the interesting aspect of this is how do you do that cost-effectively? How do we do it safely so the fields are within safety limits and are not present when the vehicle is not over those strips? And how do we do this very efficiently? And so that requires a number of challenges in how you operate these strips in the roadway and how they're segmented.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So we've got conduction and we've got induction. So this type of charging would be induction because there's no contact actually between the bottom of the car and the roadway. But and I'm wondering, I know that you're very familiar with the Proterra bus fleet that Park City Municipal has purchased, and I think the first of those buses is going to come online during the Sundance Film Festival. So these are electric buses. They will have a different type of charging station where they pull into the transit center, and it's overhead, so it's a conduction of electric charge. Is that right?
That is correct, and we've had a great relationship with Proterra, very excited about the forward thinking for Park City in purchasing a fleet of electric buses, and I think Proterra's solution is really amazing. They've done a ground-up rework of the entire bus system. They have a very efficient vehicle, and they do have a high-power conductive, as you say, charger that has an overhead contact. Really a great solution for a system like that that's running short routes, that has regular stops or overnight stops in the facility and allows you to charge those batteries from that conduction. As we move forward to the concept of what really could electric roads provide, we'll talk a little bit about how that impacts things. But the primary question, as I see it, is how do you take vehicles such as that, or even expanding that, let's say, to Class 8 trucks and freight systems, freight delivery. Now we're looking at scenarios where you really don't have a short controlled fixed route, such as a route moving in and around Park City, where you're charging every night. but rather we really need to go a longer distance or a longer haul, or we need to really operate that vehicle continuously through the day. And that's really where this concept of charge as you go can make all the difference.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, Proterra, one of the efforts that they've made significant inroads in is, you know, how can you really increase the amount of energy storage on the vehicle so you can operate their buses over a longer range during the day? And they've got, you know, phenomenal range, over 200 miles in one of their solutions. But this is really a battery-centric approach, and that does require significant cost and significant weight impact for batteries. And so that's right. So we're excited about how we could move away from that battery-centric approach for these heavier-duty, larger vehicles, and ultimately for all of us to be able to go essentially the long haul.
Okay, exciting.
Right.
So let's talk semi-trucks, and let's talk a pilot program. Read an article in the Wall Street Journal about the area around the Denver International Airport, and you are involved in this pilot project that's going to come online maybe early 2018 to do just what you're talking about, provide an electric charge for semis that are maybe going interstate.
We couldn't be more excited about this. So this is exactly the type of rollout and kind of next step that we envision, and really was the purpose of our building the EVR facility here on campus, pulling in an industry consortium together with government agencies so that we could see our technologies, you know, in real world. So we could show them at a scale that would allow people to visualize, okay, wait a minute, this technology is not as far out as you might think. You know, what if we could get this out in a real public system? And so that's exactly what's happened here. One of our industry members as part of the Select Center is AECOM, you know, world-renowned infrastructure firm. They have contracts on roadway infrastructure, I believe, in every state of the U.S., and they have a great relationship with Colorado and CDOT. And so together we've approached CDOT, and as you stated, the Wall Street Journal just put out the article on the announcement. We're going to launch over the next year into a detailed planning study with CDOT to evaluate how can we put these electric roadway concepts as a pilot project, probably, you know, let's say 1 to 5 miles as a first demonstration. And part of that project is specifically to work with local partners, local trucking companies, a trucking OEM, so that we can show what is the business story. Is this a roadway, as it rolls out, that can be done incrementally, can directly pay for itself based on the use of local trucking, and can really be a showcase for the world, but certainly for the state and the U.S., on how this technology could roll out.
Well, try to explain that for me, what it would look like. If it's this 1 to 5 mile stretch, is it a loop of road, or is it just for this, the purposes of this study? How does that unfold?
You bet. Now, the purpose of the public scale demonstration would really be to collect data and to analyze and demonstrate and show how does this operate in concrete, in realistic environment over all of the seasons with actual trucking traffic as well as passenger traffic and other vehicles operating over this road. Because as you can imagine, the advantage here of embedding this into the roadway is that the road looks exactly the same as any other road. So all cars can drive over this road. Only those that have this receiving pad would receive energy. And so the pilot project would be really just a segment of what we would envision as being the larger road that would need this to fully power a vehicle. And so what we're doing on the pilot study, on the planning study, is we're looking at, okay, which segments of road could make sense in and of themselves based on the trucking traffic that you have on that roadway. And that might be 50 miles, might be 75 miles total. Where there's, let's say, major distribution centers connecting to local centers where there's trucking traffic just going back and forth between those two. So we would identify that as a target for an early rollout. And then on that roadway, let's say that 50-mile roadway that we're identifying as a target, we would take a first 1 to 5 miles and do this pilot plant, you know, study where we embed the technology in that segment. Now, of course, that isn't going to fully power the vehicles operating on that during the pilot study. We would be embedding coils on some receiving trucks to demonstrate the feasibility of the technology and evaluate how it's working. And then based on those results, the next stage, which is something that Colorado at CDOT is interested in, would be to electrify the rest of that road. And then you could actually convert those vehicles to all electric.
Wow.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Dr. Regan Zane. He's a professor at Utah State University. And we're talking about induction-based electric vehicles or electric transportation systems, because these are systems that probably be applied to a number of different types of vehicles, whether cars, trucks, buses, rail systems. How does this differ from, say, subway systems, you know, that use a third rail as a form of power?
In terms of the overall benefit and how that could impact EV adoption, you know, the two technologies are very similar, and the technology required for connecting to the grid and distributing the power along the roadway, that would all be directly leveraged from, you know, freight cars and from subways, you know, very similar areas. The big difference is going to be in the safety and the feasibility of rolling this out on public roadways across the interstate, in and around close to the cities. This is where the high voltage, the shock hazard of the subways really wouldn't make sense without a significant change in kind of how we operate and expect conditions to be on those interstates. The other big question is the environment. This technology, by being embedded in the roadway and protected by the upper pavement, really is fully embedded and is not impacted by rain, by ice, by snow. Operates in and through all seasons.
Even salt.
Yeah, even salt.
That's a good point. And I could walk across it. And
exactly.
Say a roadway, I could walk across it and not suffer any consequences.
Exactly. And there's a specific standard. ICNIRP is the acronym tied to it. There's a standard for the allowed magnetic field to be radiated that's safe for humans. All of these systems are meeting those standards. And the basic concept is that the fields are only active when there's a receiving pad and all of the components associated with that directly over those coils. And as soon as the vehicle moves off it, there's nothing. There's no field. There's no power. And that's also how you get high efficiency. You know, energy is only transferred as the vehicle comes over and then immediately turns off.
Okay.
So in this test program at Utah State University, and I'm sure that my questions are questions of a layperson that many people have asked you, I just can't picture going 85 miles an hour and going over electric charging track and getting enough charge in that split second. You know, is this something I'm going to be driving along in my Nissan Leaf and have to slow way down to 30 to make sure I get enough charge?
Yes, that's certainly a common question. And of course, the answer here is that we anticipate this working quite well at full highway speeds. And the way to visualize that is to recognize that although as you go over a single coil in the roadway, you're only over that for a split second, as you stated. But in that same at the same rate, you're moving on to the next pad. So the faster you drive, the more quickly you move to the next pads. And bottom line is you end up continuously operating over these pads. So a better way to visualize this is that there's essentially a continuous magnetic field available for you in the roadway as you're moving. So from your perspective on the vehicle, it feels as though you're continuously getting this energy, which is what's happening as you move over. Now, if you're standing on the side of the road and you watch a vehicle come by, if you can actually visualize these invisible magnetic fields, you would see, you know, a pulse on that pad right in front of you as the vehicle comes over. But then, you know, the next pad pulses, and the end result is you're moving quickly from pad to pad, and you're continuously getting energy. And most likely, we would cover a portion of the roadway, let's say two-thirds as an example. It really depends on what the peak power is that we're transmitting from the road. But we'll transmit enough power to not only power you as you're operating, but some additional power that would provide energy to a smaller battery that you have on board. And so now you're charging the vehicle, let's say over 20 miles, then you might go another 10 miles without any roadway electrification. Then you'd be using your battery for those 10 miles.
Okay.
All right. So what about the marriage of this kind of charging track and solar roadways?
Yes, an interesting concept, and one that we have talked with a solar roadway company here in the U.S. Now, first, let's maybe just take a step back and say, in general, the marriage of this technology with renewable energy integration on the grid, clearly a major step forward. In terms of the impact on the economy as well as the impact on the environment, shifting to electrification has more than a 2 times, even 4 times improvement over burning petroleum, even with the existing grid mix. As we move to solar power and wind power, obviously that improves things significantly more. And now you're right, we do have this infrastructure available.
Wow.
If we could use it and operate that with solar roadways, that's of interest. Depending on what's cost-effective, whether it's more cost-effective to put panels on the side of the roads or on the roads, either way, we would have a great synergy between these two.
And there's a potential synergy between this and driverless vehicles. Because, again, I think of looped systems where you have these vehicles running loops, buses running loops or so on an induction-based pathway. But it could eventually lend itself to a driverless vehicle.
Absolutely. And that's really part of the synergy that within the Select Center we're actively looking into. And in fact, the demonstration that we ran here in September at our annual meeting was actually with autonomous control of our electric bus, being charged here on the track. But we do see a great synergy between those two. There has to be a change, really, looking forward in the model of our transportation network, our owner model of vehicles. I mean, our vehicles today, on average, are sitting 90%, even 95% in most areas of the time. What a resource we have sitting in parking lots and sitting in our garages most of the time. But as we move more towards an autonomous vehicle scenario, as you mentioned, that even further motivates the concept that you would like these vehicles actually operating more often than they're sitting and parked. And as you move to a more continuous operation of vehicles and loops and things, as you mentioned, that really comes back to this question of how are these vehicles, if they're going to be electric, which is where we'd like to go for the economy and for the economics, how is it we're going to be charging those vehicles? If they're operating more continuously, we have even less time to be parked and charging.
So interesting. And, you know, in Park City here, Chris, you know this, the redevelopment of Bonanza Park is nixing the Maverick gas station. And people are saying this is an essential community service, is having a gas station in town. There's only one other. But as you speak, Dr. Zane, I'm starting to think, well, maybe it's not so out of the question as we move into the future.
there's a question mark there. we'll continue to be the people that we are, and we'll continue to have our needs. We'll need opportunities to stop and have breaks, and we need to pick up snacks and eat. And
oh, yeah, the
we'll
snacks.
We'll be curious to see where that model goes.
I forgot completely about the snacks. Those are essential.
But I suppose if you're not driving, maybe we'll have a little kitchen in our vehicle.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So what's the, again, it's still roughly expanded pilot scale testing. What's the 5-year, 10-year plan? Is there a vision here that you see a broader expansion of this technology or adoption of this technology?
Absolutely. And as we've been describing, this isn't in a bubble. There are multiple associated and synergistic technologies that are rolling out together with this. Electric vehicles as a solution for the transportation network, we see expanding, and this being one of the many components that are going to be important for electric vehicle adoption. And so we see these really coming out altogether. We don't see this as the win-all solution. We see this as really the game changer for allowing electric vehicles to expand into the SUVs, the trucks, the Class 8 semi, et cetera, and for all vehicles, including small light car vehicles, to really grow in adoption because of their ability now to go for the long haul. In terms of rollout, over the next 5 years, we would really see this continuing into the pilot scale study and early rollout demonstrations. Early adopters, we believe, would be fleet operated vehicles, which would include kind of the local freight, could also include kind of controlled environments. It'd be great to see this for routes along Zion National Park or other national parks, ports of entry, as Long Beach, LA area. So these would be the early rollouts. In addition, and this is part of our industry partnership at the center, there's also off-road vehicles that are running in their own closed-circuit routes, such as forklifts and earth-moving vehicles, things like this. Again, vehicles that you'd think, oh, these take so much energy. Is it possible? Well, yeah, electric motors are even more efficient than what they have today if they could power them in these short routes that they're running. So these also look like early adopters in the next 5 to 10 years. So looking kind of 5 years out, I would see demonstration pilot projects like the one we're running in Colorado being implemented, deployed, and being tested and evaluated. As we look out now into 10 years, I'd like to see those being expanded into 50-mile, 75-mile demonstrations in and around a few pockets of major cities in some of these early adoption we mentioned. And then as that technology, as well as associated adoption of electric vehicles in general, home charging, workplace charging, all the stationary charging we've just talked about, more cities like Park City really adopting electric buses. This is really what I see happening over those next 10 years. And that will really be the catalyst to consider major change. This would be larger U.S. kind of societal decision if we're going to, over the next 20 to 40 years, say, okay, let's start rolling technologies like this, including electric roadways, out over interstate highways and do this in a broader scale. We could see, in my view, then, let's see, over the next 30 years, a full broad-scale rollout of this across interstate highways, connecting all the major cities. And that could really support, even 25, 30, even up to 50% adoption of electric vehicles over that time frame.
Okay. I have to ask you this. Why Utah State University?
Interesting
Why
question.
Not?
Well, why not?
Why on earth not? Well, it is interesting. And, we hope Utah is going to come out as the kind of unexpected underdog here in being a U.S. leader for kind of this innovative thinking and forward thinking for the environment and for cost-effective solutions on electrification. One advantage we have here at Utah State is you look at our center, we include Purdue University, universities in Colorado, Virginia, we're bringing in some in California. But one unique aspect that allowed us bringing in this facility is, we do have some land. We have land, we have a forward-thinking government. We have a positive cash flow in the state, which has allowed the universities to be supported in a positive way, whereas some of our partners in other states have had significant cuts recently. So I think these are part of the reason why Utah. But on the other hand, or similar, there's a lot of interest here in Utah, although most in the U.S. wouldn't realize it. But we do actually have an air quality problem, and that's also raised interest in investment and solutions for that that challenge.
And again, going back to the technology, this system can be, like we say, retrofit into existing roads and tied into the existing electrical grid. The second part, A, is that correct? And B, is does it apply a lot of additional pressure to the existing grid? How does Rocky Mountain Power address a potential transportation-based grid like this?
Sure. That's certainly an important question, and it's also an important opportunity. And right. We've been discussing with a number of utilities different opportunities here. We have two utilities associated with our research center, including Rocky Mountain Power or Pacific Corp here in our area. What this actually turns out to be is one of the biggest growth market opportunities for utilities that they've seen in decades. The growth market for utility is typically at the rate of growth of population, but it's actually even a little bit below that because over the past few decades we've had efficiency improvements. So it's a little bit slower than population growth. So now considering moving into the EV charging market, this is a huge opportunity. Now, early adoption, as we kind of look at that 5 to 10 year time frame, it looks to be that the existing grid can easily absorb the requirements that we're discussing here. The challenge here will be the specific requirements in a location. How much is this loading a given transformer or a given distribution network at a given time? And so that's one thing the utilities are particularly interested in, is this going to be just going to be like renewable energy, where, oh, it's going to provide all these benefits, but, by the way, it's not supporting you during peak loads, and it's only helping you in times where you weren't as interested.
Right.
So is this going to be a peaking load for them, which would make it a challenge, or is it going to be brought, spread out? So that's something that we're looking into, and that's partly why we'd be considering integrating energy storage with our solution along the roadway as a grid-scale energy storage. And that way, during the peak demand times of the grid, we could offload and kind of shift our loading away from those times, but continue to pull energy from the grid over the rest of the day and through the evening. So it looks like this could be supported, but there's certainly interest over the next decade or two in improving and enhancing the grid as it is. I think this would be a great technology for combining with that.
So just one last question, Regan, and that is, we've talked about retrofitting roadways. What about retrofitting, you know, the person that owns a 2016 Nissan Leaf that's listening right now? How's that person going to retrofit that car?
Is that possible?
Is it possible? Yeah.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's even possible today. So the solution for instance, in wireless charging, stationary wireless charging, as we mentioned at the very beginning of the call, is actually here today. Really just the convenience of not having to plug in the vehicle. There are commercial vendors supplying retrofit solutions, and I believe the Leaf is one that's on the market today to put a wireless receiving pad on your vehicle. And now our plan for these dynamic electric roadways that charge as you go is to make them compatible with those same stationary chargers that you would use in your garage and when you're parking at home or at work. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is, a listener that has a Nissan Leaf, or particularly one of those 100,000 plus that are planning on the Tesla 3 as it comes out, you can retrofit in with the wireless charger. You can use that at home. Hopefully you can convince your workplace to provide that as well. And as these electric roadways roll out, now you can take that same Nissan Leaf that's currently running 90 miles, pretty soon will be running 200 miles. Now you can run the long haul along these electric roads with the same vehicle. Automotive OEMs are also planning rollout of options for providing the wireless charger on their vehicle. Toyota announced in 2018 they're expecting that as an available option on their vehicles.
Great. So I can drive to Montana to see my mom in my electric car.
No excuses now.
No excuses. And hopefully that means you don't have to own three or four vehicles. You don't need your little short-range electric vehicle and your family vehicle and your long-range vehicle.
Exactly. Well, we will be following with great anticipation your work in the pilot study in around Denver. Dr. Regan Zane from Utah State University, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Lynn and Chris, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Take care. And how about that? That's exciting. Stay with us. We'll be back to talk microscopy. Did I say it right?
And a new business in town.
That's right. When we return, it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Chris Cherniak, Lynn Ware Peak across the board. Well, Lynn.
Chris.
There are microscopes and then there are microscopes. And Park City is about to gain access to a super high resolution microscope. Joining us to talk about this cutting edge technology is Dr. Brian Bennett. He is with Park City Microscopy Corps, and he's here to explain what this technology and what the business is all about. Dr. Bennett, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Well, let's start with the science. What is a high resolution microscope?
It's been my work my entire career. The premise or the idea that started in the early 2000s was that we could move beyond the diffraction limit of a traditional microscope. So for most of 1990, 2000, we were using confocal microscopes to study biological processes, even materials, and super resolution came around where we could move beyond the diffraction limit or Abbey's law, mm-hmm. which tells us what the resolution is. And so there were several different ways we approached this. And the culmination is our ability in two dimensions to see as low as 20 nanometers, which is a single strand of DNA is 10 nanometers.
Wow.
A viral component is 30 to 50 nanometers. So we're able to actually see single molecules now and 2D. And then we moved into 3D, three dimensions while I was a professor at the University of Utah. And I created a system that is commercially available through Bruker Sciences that does three dimensions. And it's a POM system, or photo activation light microscopy.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were able to do with that was study my biological end, or biochemistry end of my research, is breast cancer and DNA damage. And that's been a very big passion of mine. This all started because when I looked at the first pictures as a grad student, I said, wow, that's just blurry.
Yeah.
Okay, so
let's
great.
Make it better.
There's light in the nucleus.
Right.
So that wasn't good enough. So that started my journey in optical physics. And so I published, and I'll reference this to explain why we're doing the business
right.
model. In 2006, I published the phosphorylation at the DNA site, the damage site, and breast cancer-specific cell line.
Mm-hmm.
And was able to quantify how much phosphorylation was taking place in a three-dimensional space, and also calculate the three-dimensional space of the nucleus. So this technology brought this science forward very quickly, and then it died. There hasn't been a paper that brought that forward since 2006. Here we are in 2016, and we're still sitting in the same place. And there's just one or two simple reasons. One is cost. These microscopes are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
They are over the amount where a traditional grant will cover them. So you have to work with the university and the state. It can take 3 to 5 years. And by that time, the technology is obsolete.
Yeah.
So how do you get access? And it's a chicken and an egg. So I need data to get a grant or publish a paper, but I can't have access to the data to write the grant,
mm, right.
And if I had it, then I could get the grant, and then I could get the equipment. So I've since this all started, I saw a real need for a core facility where people could simply make their samples, send them in, or come to beautiful Park City, my hometown, and that's why it's here.
Okay.
And get the data they need. A super resolution image can literally move any field of science forward in a single image.
So I'm starting to grasp why you're so excited about this.
I am very excited.
And it really emanates from your website and reading the tweets and everything about how this is coming to fruition, and you're so excited. So I'm starting to understand. But let's back up a little bit so our listeners and so we here in the studio can understand exactly. So what I'm hearing you say is, you know, basically the super resolution microscope allows you to look at, say, a tumor in a way that's never been looked at before, never been able to
on
be
a molecular
seen.
Level.
Yes. And if the best example of what super resolution is, take off in an airplane at night. As you first take off, you can see the streetlights. You can see the car headlights. And then those become blurry. And you can see the buildings. And then those become blurry. And eventually, you're flying over Chicago, and it's just one big light blur.
Right.
That's basically all we were ever able to see was localization, not structure. This technology allows us to look at structure, binding partners, protein binding partners, localization at a much higher detail, as we did in 2006. So it's a very important technology.
Okay. And when you talk about the resolution, again, I go to the doctor. I think I have strep throat. They take a swab of my throat. They look under the microscope. What is the level of resolution that they're getting in that type of microscope?
Microns.
Microns.
And we're in the nanometer level.
Wow.
So if you think about it, a human hair is 5 to 10 microns, where a virus, a single virus capsule, if you've ever seen one, they kind of look like a spider with a
right.
head on it, is 30 to 50 nanometers. Well, we could never see that before. So if we were studying a viral entry into a cell, all we would see is just blurry fluorescence. And maybe it's in the cytoplasm, maybe it's in the nucleus, maybe it's on the nuclear boundary, but that's all we could tell. And now we can actually study it singularly, or any other protein, or in material science even, material stress wear, stuff like that. Super resolution is used by some of the car manufacturers to study ceramic brakes and how the material holds up at the that nanometer level.
Wow.
Right. I was going to ask you, who are the potential clients here?
The world.
Yeah.
This is what is so exciting to me. This is where I really get kind of a little
giddy.
Yeah, I am giddy. I will give you that. Because nobody has access. When I was at the University of Utah, I was working with Eric Jorgensen, who is a Howard Hughes professor. I was in a Howard Hughes lab. Now, Howard Hughes labs have good funding. We still didn't have access. I built the one that we had.
Okay.
So I built one from the ground up that is now the 3D most powerful unit that exists. If you look around the University of Utah, which is a well-funded university, there is super resolution, but it's very limited. And let's say we have one per department, which would be a dream. We don't. How many people are competing for that time?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that people know this, but if you use a departmental instrument at a university, you pay for that.
Mm.
And there's no one to guide you. You just pay, you walk in, and you turn
some
knobs,
and you hope you know what
you're doing. Yeah. There are good core leaders. The university has good core leaders that will help you. But it's not dedicated to a singular mission. Where that's what we are. We are the best photographers, if you will,
mm-hmm.
of these samples. And one of the amazing things about this opportunity was that Zeiss is a foundation. Everybody knows them in optics. They have several super resolution platforms, and we have partnered with them. So Zeiss is actually a partner to us in this venture.
So Zeiss didn't build the microscope, to ask if you did, or they supplied
lenses. Well, they all end up in commercial hands.
Mm-hmm.
So my microscope started as a private company out of the University of Utah, then was acquired by Bruker, which is a big international company. Zeiss's technology, their Palm system is based on technology that myself and my colleagues have worked on. Their new system, and it's installed, and we are already doing super resolution, is a what's called an AeriScan system, which is something that's been was a really great idea. Sometimes science, the best ideas are the later seem to be the simplest. If you imagine throwing a pebble in a pond, where that pebble hits is your localization spot. That's where you want. That's what you're interested in. But you get all those ripples. And the problem in light is that we see all those ripples. Mm-hmm. So this AeriScan system removes all those and lets us just see where that pebble hit in the pond. So that's how we achieve those resolutions. So that scope has a resolution of about 120 nanometers, and that is up and running. And in fact, we have Zeiss in our facility this morning installing 4 more systems.
Wow.
We're speaking with Dr. Brian Bennett. He is the proprietor, of the Park City Microscopy Corps, a business coming to town. And here's something interesting. It's not a restaurant. It's a new business coming to town.
Or an art gallery.
Unless you serve food.
Or an art gallery,
okay. Unless
well,
you have
wait,
art
maybe,
and food.
Well,
you see
we
some
are
synergies
on the art
there.
Side.
Okay.
We are on the art side.
Okay.
You
right.
are.
That's right. The art of the science behind.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking, potential clients. Like you say, the world – is your oyster here
it
with
really
who
is.
Might be interested. You say the auto industry, which doesn't necessarily, you know, pop up immediately. The military might be interested in this. Pharmaceutical
I've actually worked
industry,
with them on this.
The food industry, the agricultural industry.
Oh, this covers.
This is making what maybe once was theory reality in a sense, right? Because you now it's observable, which maybe in the past was more theoretical.
And this is the only privately owned by someone with experience in this field core in the world.
How'd you get your funding?
Myself.
Very carefully. Very laboriously.
Yeah, I've my last company was started with the traditional investment round and everything, and you, as the inventor or the idea generator, it's your baby. And my experience with having investors was that I don't know how this sounds. We go to school and we work hard to earn our opinion.
Yes.
And so because I know this field intimately, this is all I've done. I felt it was important that I had control. So I actually have been retired for a few years.
Just waiting to sink your savings into this.
Yes, yes, exactly. I went from Park City Coffee Roasters to Cafe Rio to Netflix to 15-hour days. But, you know, my dream, when I started my first biotech company with the university, it was funded here locally. And my dream was to bring biotech to Park City. It always has been. This is my town. Now, I could go to Salt Lake and do this a lot less expensive. But why? The Silver Mountain building in Kimball Junction, where we are, I've been going to that building for years to the gym, and I know Stanton very well, who owns the building, and he loves the dream as well. And we said, you know, think of the secondary revenue for the town. We're bringing in PhDs. We're bringing in educated people, high earners. The spillover. So we have I decided to employ a concierge.
So I noticed that.
When people book, we can take care of their hotels, their
activities, their ski instructors.
Because I have a feeling once they get here, they're gonna be like, they're gonna say, Brian, you take the pictures. I'm going to hit the mountain, you know, right. Or I want to go have dinner or whatever. And then we're totally fine with that.
But it's a process that can that takes some time to do. It's not like they show up with a sample.
No, you never hit it the first time.
You know, I'll have their photos for you at the end of the day. This takes some time. So they're going to be here for some time or plan around that.
Yes.
And then maybe they want to do some research while they're here.
Yes. You
know, okay.
Yeah. And, and if you look at my paper from 2006 in Super Resolution, there were thousands of hours into getting those images, quantifiable images.
Where can we see these images? Are they available?
They're on my, my papers are on my personal website, which is drbrianbennett.com.
Okay.
There's also a little backstory about why I left science and why I came back and how much I love what I do.
Do you have a link to that on your website?
Yes.
Okay.
If you go to our PCMicroscopyCorps.com site and about us, my bio is there with my picture. And at the end is a link to my personal site, which just is a living curriculum vitae, if you will. Mm-hmm. My papers are there. My thesis is there. Why I do what I do. There's some really cool videos. And just to, you know, it's a really neat example of how limited access is to this. In 2005, I imaged the nuclear pore complexes using 4-pi microscopy, and the three-dimensional. That was the first one on the market. I was with Leica at the time. And I imaged them, and then I used an algorithm that myself and my colleague wrote to count the number of nuclear pores. And it matched the biochemical data that had been published exactly. We never published it. And I put it on my personal website, the drbrianbennett.com site. It's right on the homepage. That data has never been seen until I put it out on that site a couple months ago.
Why?
So we have data. I have so much data that has not been seen just because the paper process is arduous at best. I'm not a fan of writing. So, okay. But anyway, just to show you the power.
I just have to ask, you say Park City is your town. Were you raised here, or you mean your adult life you've spent
adult here? Adult life, yeah. Yeah, so I am as broken as possibly can be by snowboarding, and that's my second love. And in fact, the microscope that I built at the university, the idea came to me while sitting on the ground up at McConkie's, staring out over the hill, waiting to go down. And I just always found peace here. Mm-hmm. My first biotech company, I started in Lake Placid, so I could snowboard.
Okay.
And after that sold, I came here, and the university recruited me in about 2 days.
Because all good snowboarders and scientists come west to Utah.
I think I'm a bit of a contradiction. But, right. Yeah.
But that's your founding. We only have a few minutes left. Let's talk about the open house you're having.
Yeah. So
tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going to have the city council and I think the mayor, Jose, has he confirmed? Yeah, yeah. The mayor's going to be there, and some people within the industry are going to be there. We're not completely outfitted yet. All our scopes are outfitted. And if I never see a paintbrush again, I will be happy. But we are, yeah, we're going to show the town what we're trying to do here.
So will I be able to look through that microscope tomorrow at the grand opening and see something incredible?
You don't need to look through it. We have big screen monitors that will show it to you.
Okay.
It's a bit strain on the eyes. The oculars seem, I don't even know why we have them anymore.
Really? Because they're just, everything's projected.
Yeah, basically you're focusing through an automated process and looking on a screen. All of the microscopes will be up and running.
It was an invitation-only grand opening. If there's someone listening to this interview right now who is just dying, maybe it's another snowboarder slash scientist.
Or whatever. Yeah,
they're dying to come.
They could email us
or
call us. Our email is contact@pcmicroscopycorps.com.
Mm-hmm.
And our 800 number is 844-880-0691.
It's right on the
homepage. It's on the homepage. Don't hold me to that.
And right up front, you say 3 hours, $1,200, which I have no idea what
absurd.
The market price. It's absurd. Okay.
Yeah.
So when do you start booking people?
We've already started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is taking off rapidly. We've already employed 7 people. So I think, too, the economy was a big issue for me after the election and the changes in the corporate structure that'll take place.
Hmm.
It allows money to go further,
mm-hmm.
which means more jobs. Our first 2 employees are already on board, and everybody's kind of coming on board over the next few days. So, and the other thing, too, is I look forward to working with the school system as well. Internships.
Yeah.
Because,
that's
kids
great.
They see me driving around town and tattoos and everything else, and they're like, I'm a scientist. You can't be a scientist. Science is fun.
It is.
Right.
And you're going to prove that.
And
Dr.
I will
Brian
prove it.
Bennett, Park City Microscopy Corps, grand opening tomorrow on Ute Boulevard in the Silver Mountain Spa building. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
on
you
Cold Science.
So much for having me.
All right.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. It's KPCW Park City. I want to thank our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.